Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Justice Department hit the drug maker Pfizer with a $2.3 billion fine this morning for illegally pushing physicians to prescribe its products. The doctor will see you now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, sponsoring the retirement planning documentary Retirement Revolution, September 15th on PBS. Local listings at pbs.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 2nd of September today. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday. So you go to your doctor. She gives you medicine. So far, so good. Within the limits of ethics and good medical practice, she can prescribe almost anything she wants to treat whatever ailment you have. Where it gets tricky is when you bring pharmaceutical manufacturers into the equation. They can only market the drugs they make to treat the specific illnesses the FDA has approved it to treat. To do otherwise is what you call off-label marketing, and that is why Pfizer is going to have to come up with $2.3 billion in civil and criminal fines. From Washington, Marketplace's Tamara Keith reports.
Doctors prescribe drugs off-label all the time, often with good results, but there are downsides too. Dr. Caleb Alexander at the University of Chicago cites a study that found nearly 75% of off-label drug uses lack scientific support.
We're talking about tens of millions of prescriptions a year. This is not a small volume of therapies.
There's big money in selling a drug for more than one use. And in this case, Pfizer marketed uses that weren't approved, says Tony West, an assistant attorney general at the Justice Department.
Pfizer asked the FDA if it could promote the sale of Bextra, which is an anti-inflammatory drug, for certain other uses and in doses which were higher than the approved maximum. The FDA, citing safety concerns, said no, but Pfizer marketed Bextra for those unapproved uses anyway.
Pfizer says it regrets actions taken in the past. Doctors learn about off-label uses from colleagues, journal articles, and continuing education courses, often sponsored by drug companies. Pfizer also supplied a curriculum that illegally pushed off-label uses of its drugs. Dr. Alexander recently conducted a survey of physicians about several common drugs.
We examined physicians' use of quetiapine to treat dementia with agitation.
That's an off-label use of the antipsychotic drug. At the time of the survey, the FDA was advising doctors to be careful about using it in dementia patients.
And yet nearly one in five of the physicians we surveyed erroneously thought that it was FDA approved.
Could that be the power of marketing? In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
There was a gusher of news from the oil giant BP this morning. We'll go with the most promising part of it first. The company has tapped what is described as a giant oil field 250 miles out in the Gulf of Mexico. The not-so-promising part here is that the mother lode is as deep as an oil drill has ever gone underwater, as far as 4,000 feet down. We could be looking at a 10-year wait before any of that oil shows up on the market, and that is if going to get it is even worth it. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
It's either a hopeful sign that the world might not really be running on empty after all, or an indication of how desperate our thirst for oil has become. Some skeptics contend this discovery doesn't really help much. For starters, they say it will inevitably necessitate higher prices. But analyst Stephen Schork argues that's exactly what the marketplace is responding to.
It brings home the adage in economics that high prices are the best cure for high prices, because you make the price high enough, someone out there is going to invent the technology to get the supply to the market.
Stephen Lieb watches the oil industry at Lieb Capital.
Look, if oil were $5,000 a barrel, it'd probably make sense to look for oil on the moon.
Lieb is convinced that bringing this undersea treasure to the surface will prove prohibitively expensive.
When you're drilling a depth equivalent to Mount Everest into the water, you're going to need oil prices significantly higher than they are today.
Stephen Short counters that recently successful deep-sea exploration in the area suggests a possible trend, and that would put oil speculators on the defensive.
Part of the run-up in oil prices over the past 4 years has been the perception the world was running out of oil. But the oil is there, and the technology, more importantly, is proving to get it out.
Stephen Lieb still isn't impressed, though. He points out a possible 3 billion barrels sounds like a lot, but not next to the 25 billion from Alaska's Prudhoe Bay, for example. And the likely daily output would be a mere drop in the bucket.
300,000 barrels a day in the context of a world that right now is consuming, you know, close to 85 million barrels a day is just not significant in terms of the oil scene.
Lieb does allow that the find should provide a significant boost to the fortunes of BP and its partners. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It turns out municipal finances can be remarkably similar to our own. They borrow. They go to the bond market, where they get loans at fixed rates that don't have to be paid back for a while. Kind of like a typical fixed-rate mortgage, really. This year, though, has been anything but typical for cities like Philadelphia. The city of brotherly love is in desperate need of cash, so it's getting the money it needs from J.P. Morgan. It is a bank loan, but the adjustable rate on it makes it look like the kind of mortgage that got this economy into a boatload of trouble. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Philadelphia's treasurer Rebecca Reinhart says because of budget woes, bond investors were demanding an interest rate that Philadelphia couldn't afford to pay.
We didn't feel like we could get into the public market at an acceptable rate. And J.P. Morgan offered us what we consider a very reasonable rate through the end of November in the private placement.
She's talking about a $275 million loan. The city will pay 3% interest to begin with, but the rate jumps to 8% in December. Reinhart says the city should be able to refinance the loan by that time. And really, what other option is there?
No other bank was able to produce any type of viable alternative or option like J.P. Morgan did.
J.P. Morgan calls it good business to lend to a city or state in need and says it's confident it'll be paid back. The bank's already lent money to New Jersey and California. And a spokesman told Marketplace the directives to make these loans come straight from the top of the organization. Tom Doe is CEO of Municipal Market Advisors. He says cities and states almost never go to banks for money these days. It almost seems like a blast from the past to him.
You know, you build a bridge and you go down to the bank and you organize a loan and you don't get involved in the marketplace. You just deal directly with the lender.
Doe says this doesn't mean Philly's done with the bond market. If anything, he says the city is trying to prove to hesitant bond investors that it can pay back a loan in a timely manner. And with reports indicating a rough fiscal year ahead for the nation's cities, Philadelphia will need all the help it can get. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There was this today from the Securities and Exchange Commission about the Bernie Madoff affair. Oops. That's the really short version of a 450-page Inspector General's report that called the agency's failure to follow up on six warnings about Madoff's Ponzi scheme incompetent. On Wall Street today, some sound, not much fury, a little bit of significance. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The House and Senate aren't even back at work yet, but the health care debate got kicked up a notch today all the same. The buzz around Washington, widely reported but not yet confirmed by the White House, is that the president will make an address to Congress next Wednesday. Speculation is that he's ready to drop what's known as the public option, that is, a government insurance program, as part of a deal to get some kind of bill passed. Policy is often largely about the politics of an issue, but commentator David Frum suggests that for health care, it's personal, too.
How much does healthcare matter, really? The numbers suggest that for most of us, individual behaviors matter more than anything doctors do. The U.S. spends 60% more of national income on healthcare than the other advanced countries. Yet American life expectancy ranks below Italy's and Portugal's. Let me suggest four simple actions to extend and improve American life and save hundreds of billions of dollars. Number one, everybody wear a seatbelt. Even now, one-fifth of American motorists go unbelted. The National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration projects that more than 1,600 lives could be saved and more than 22,000 serious injuries prevented every year if Americans wore their seatbelts as often as Germans and Brits do. Number two, smokers. Please quit. One-fifth of Americans currently smoke, and almost 9 million Americans suffer a smoking-related disease. We spend $75 billion per year treating those who will die from smoking. Those who live will incur costs of tens of billions more. Number three, everybody lose weight. Obesity is not nearly as lethal as smoking, but its health consequences are much more costly. About one health dollar in nine for everything from type 2 diabetes to premature hip and joint disease. Number four, and above all, if you're a woman of childbearing years, please take extra care of yourself. Our infant mortality statistics are awful, worse than Cuba's. It's these infant deaths that pull down American life expectancy overall. Once Americans reach 65, American life expectancy ranks a respectable ninth in the world. Why so many infant deaths? The shockingly high American incidence of premature birth, about one baby in eight. And the most important causes of premature birth are controllable: smoking during pregnancy, drinking, drugs, maternal overweight, and sexually transmitted diseases. We all want wider health access and a more rational healthcare system. But a big obstacle to a better system is our expectation that doctors, hospitals, and machines will save us from the harms we do to ourselves.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Your thoughts are always welcome. Online works best. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Despite snippets of good news here and there, overall real estate continues to suffer, as do some of the people who make their living from it. Realtors are taking home less money. Many have quit the field altogether. But the industry itself has also been slow to react to the new realities. A lot of real estate agents continue to do things the way they have for decades, charging hefty commissions and letting properties sit out there on the market for months. Mitchell Hartman from our entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting checked out Seattle's real estate market, where one startup is trying something a little bit different.
We're sitting out here on our deck of our new modern home that we both love.
Connor O'Sullivan and his partner Ryan Powell bought this hillside home in May. Floor-to-ceiling windows frame a white baby grand.
We have a vista with a lot of green in it, and over to the right, there's the bay.
The couple moved to Seattle from Chicago to work for Microsoft. They started their search there using the online discount realty company Redfin.
The original asking price was
$895, and then the builder lowered that to $830, and then we ended up paying $780.
O'Sullivan and Powell found Redfin does things differently. The company posts much more data online than other realty sites, like price and mortgage history. That makes it easier for buyers to size up the property before making an offer. And Redfin pays clients a rebate. Buyers get back half of the traditional 3% commission an agent usually pockets. Sellers get a similar deal. O'Sullivan and Powell got $12,000. Redfin can afford this because its agents work mostly online rather than driving clients around on home tours and trolling for new business at open houses, and it pays them in a completely different way.
I'm actually paid a salary to do what I do.
Allie Howard was one of Redfin's first agents in Seattle. I met her at the company's annual meeting. On top of her salary, she gets a bonus based on customer satisfaction rather than a cut of the commission.
And I don't have that extra pressure of being nervous about losing a potential commission. I can just give the very best advice that I can. Sometimes it's brutally honest. People don't like it. But nobody wants to go on the market at the wrong price and waste 6 months of their lives while their property goes down the tubes.
Redfin's approach has attracted the ire of realtors in some markets.
Nobody really wanted to play with us. I was literally called the enemy once.
In some cases, the company's for sale signs were torn down, and competitors balked at negotiating deals. But not all realtors take offense. Gary Majors is a Portland REMAX broker, and he heads the local Realtors Association. He's confident that buyers and sellers will continue to use full-service agents like himself.
I think the place of the full-service realtor is to take the transaction from start to finish, from disclosures to getting feedback from showings and getting some of those ducks in a row ahead of time. There's some really key things that happen, and that falls on the shoulders of a realtor to bring all of that together.
Still, in this cutthroat market, what matters to many customers isn't full service so much as low price. Glenn Kelman is CEO of Redfin.
What we want to do is change the game and attack the real estate industry so we can make it more efficient.
Kelman notes that ordinarily, realtors earn twice as much for selling a $500,000 house as one for $250,000. And often, the more you pay for a house, the more your traditional real estate agent makes. By changing that incentive model, Kelman believes he can offer clients a better deal.
Our goal isn't to be the best rinky-dink little website. Our goal is to be a new way to buy homes, the number one brokerage in the country.
Redfin has a ways to go. The company's still tiny compared to chains like REMAX and Coldwell Banker. But Richard Green of USC's Lusk Center for Real Estate says traditional realty services are becoming less necessary now that buyers can see almost every listing on the market without leaving home.
Having a model where people examine what's on the market online and narrow for themselves what they want, it's just not that big a deal. You really don't need somebody to draw you around to look for houses that are going to fit your needs.
The Redfin approach is catching on fast. The 5-year-old startup just turned a profit. It has offices in Washington, California, Chicago, New York, Boston, and the D.C. area. It'll be in Portland and Atlanta by year's end, pressing its key value proposition that it aligns the financial interests of agents and clients better than the competition. It's a business model that could save home buyers and sellers a room full of money. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, regulating downward dogs.
Yoga is supposed to be about peace and love and everybody getting along, right? No, we don't need rules. We don't need the government.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell a third of 1% today. 29 points closed at 9,280. The NASDAQ slipped nearly a tenth of 1%. 1 point finished at 1,967. The S&P 500 also lost a third of 1%. 3 points ended at 994. The big board closing bell, by the way, today rung remotely down in Atlanta, Georgia. Coca-Cola shares, speaking of which, 2.6% to the upside. We talked about Pfizer's fine earlier in the show. The drug company fell 0.6% on that news. Merck dropped nearly 2%. Schering Plow dipped 1.3%. Financials took a beating for a second straight day, with smaller banks especially hard hit. SunTrust dimmed 7%. Regions Financial dropped more than 6% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, Vice President Biden talks about the progress of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Did back-to-school shopping send consumers to the malls? Chain stores report sales figures for August. And television soap Search for Tomorrow premiered on September 3rd, 1951. The search went on for 35 years. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Along with his constitutional responsibility of presiding over the United States Senate, Vice President Joe Biden is also the guy charged with keeping an eye on the Obama administration's economic stimulus program. He will give us an update on that one tomorrow from Washington. But out in the actual economy, stimulus money is trickling down to projects across the country. We've been keeping tabs on one of them the past 6 months or so, the Coconino Rural Environment Corps just outside Flagstaff in northern Arizona. It employs young people in a slew of mostly outdoor occupations like trail building and habitat maintenance. Dustin Woodman manages the project. Dustin, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you again, Kai. Thanks for having us.
So we had you on the air, I guess, back in June. What's been going on with you stimulus-wise since then?
a great deal. We've actually brought on our first entirely recovery-funded cruise. We've brought on 19 employees under recovery funding, and we've put them through our training curriculum, and we have them currently out in the field doing a great variety of natural resource conservation work.
We went back over the tape before I came in here, and it was about 55 or 56 that you wanted to hire, and you just tell me now you had, 19 or 20?
That's true. We decided that because of the challenges in matching resources for these recovery grants that we would stagger our program a little bit. So we've actually completed a second recruitment cycle, and we're going to be starting additional recovery members the first week of October.
Let me ask you to turn to the guy next to you, Russ Dickerson. He's a supervisor on one of the Coconino crews out there. Russ, what's it been like for you out there, having gotten this new job now?
Oh, it's great. Because of all the recovery funds, I got an opportunity to be a supervisor for a recovery-funded crew.
So what kind of work are you doing out there?
Well, we've been to the Grand Canyon for the last two trips, working on the South Kaibab Trail and reinforcing it so that the mules don't do too much damage. And this next trip, we're doing general trail maintenance near Flagstaff.
Yeah, those mules are ugly out on that trail, I'll tell you what. So listen, tell me about the folks that have been hired, Russ, and that you're working with. Where do they come from, and what does this opportunity mean to them, do you think?
Well, we're coming from all different backgrounds. I think four of the people on my crew already have college degrees, and then four are kind of somewhere in the high school, not yet finished with undergraduate realm. And, I think it means a whole lot. People apply for this job because it's the sort of thing that they want to do. It gives people an opportunity to do a lot of self-reflection, to work in the woods, and just to get a whole bunch of experiences that they've never had before.
Do I have it right that you named your crew after the stimulus package?
Yeah. Our crew is, it's named MRAH.
Is
pronounced, but yeah, that's a pronunciation of an acronym for the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
American, yes, very clever you guys are out there.
Yeah.
Dustin, are you expecting any more money out of the stimulus package?
We are, actually. We're looking forward to a new program that we're hoping to start up this fall in the area of residential energy conservation. And we're looking forward to some additional recovery funds from Department of Energy to help fund that program. The recovery funding certainly has added additional administrative work for us. It's basically added 25 to 50% to our programming with the existing capacity of existing staff. So it's been a challenge, definitely, but all of us are committed to do our part towards local economic recovery.
You know, Northern Arizona is a rural place. It's not a place you think of, really, when you think of economic development. How necessary were these jobs for that region?
You know, extremely necessary, I believe. One of the populations most heavily hit by the current economic crisis in our area, and I think across the country, is the age group that we focus on, young adults and youth age 15 to 25. So providing jobs and job training opportunities for that age group specifically helps to stimulate the economy through their spending. And the side effects of that are the work that gets performed on public lands that help to enrich recreational experiences for tourists, and hopefully thereby stimulating the tourist industry, which is a huge piece of the local economy.
Dustin Woodman, he's a program manager for the Coconino Rural Environment Corps out in northern Arizona. Russ Dickerson works for him on one of the crews out there that was made possible by stimulus money. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the opportunity, Kai.
Hey, thank you very much.
I'm a day late on this one, but welcome to National Yoga Awareness Month, everybody. You may not need a reminder that yoga is a $6 billion industry in this country. Maybe you're one of the 16 million Americans with a yoga mat tucked under your desk. For the rest of us, it's worth noting that yoga has become an exercise in very big business. And with that comes something that leaves many devotees of the practice in a twist. A growing number of states are trying to regulate the yoga industry. Lisa Napoli reports.
Becca Hughes fell in love with yoga 8 years ago. Now she runs her own studio in Oklahoma. Hughes says there used to be one path to get to teach yoga.
Years ago, you would have had to have worked with your guru or your teacher for many, many, many years until they finally told you, okay, you're ready now.
Today, if you want to make yoga your profession, you pay to take a teacher training class. Courses can last from a few days to a few weeks and cover topics from anatomy to meditation.
Okay, finish up.
Here in California's Pacific Palisades, a few dozen would-be instructors are huddled over thick textbooks. They're analyzing illustrations of yoga poses. This 200-hour course costs over $3,000. Mark Davis is president of the industry trade group Yoga Alliance, which is based in Arlington, Virginia. Davis says the alliance has been trying to professionalize the business of yoga for 10 years.
There was concern that there were people out there charging a lot of money. Students were getting hurt because of inappropriate training of the teachers.
Now, educational laws that have been on the books for decades are being used to clamp down on yoga teacher training schools. About a dozen states have started scrutinizing curriculum and imposing licensing fees. Wisconsin was among the first. Pat Sweeney is with the state's Educational Approval Board.
We want to make sure if somebody signs up to go to a school that the program is good and they get their money's worth.
Sweeney says his job isn't to regulate yoga. It's to make sure the schools are legit.
What happens if somebody doesn't show up? What happens if somebody drops out after the second week? How much of a refund do they get? We want all of those things spelled out.
The same kinds of regulations that govern other vocational schools, like those that teach pet grooming and truck driving. Fees for licensing vary state by state, from a few $100s to several thousand. Yoga teacher Becca Hughes paid $1,200 to get licensed by Oklahoma. She says many of her fellow yogis around the nation have been balking at not just the cost of licensing, but at the very idea of interference.
Yoga is supposed to be about peace and love and everybody getting along, right? No, we don't need rules. We don't need the government.
And yet, governments are stretching their reach ever more into yoga. Earlier this year, yoga studios in Michigan were given a week to undergo state certification. And in New York, the state tried to shut down 80 yoga teacher training programs. The New York effort's been pushed back for now. But those who watch the industry say regulation of yoga across the country is inevitable. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, Charlie Gibson is hanging it up. Gibson announced this morning that come January, he will be stepping down as the anchor of ABC's World News Tonight. An older man leaving his job, even a high-profile one, is not in and of itself news, unless he is being replaced by a high-profile woman. Diane Sawyer will leave Good Morning America in January and move to the evening show. We asked Brad Adgate at Horizon Media whether gender in the anchor chair should really matter anymore.
I think at this day and age is not as important a factor as it was, say, when Barbara Walters became the anchor with Harry Reasoner a generation ago. I think at this stage the networks want to stem the erosion of the viewers that they have.
Last we checked, ABC was number two behind NBC in the nightly news sweepstakes. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 29 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ down 1 point, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 also fell 1 point, a tenth of 1% there. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, resumes on tape.
My shtick is about the energy I bring to a room. If somebody sees me on a video, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to get what my personality is about.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, radio only here. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.